Hi and welcome to Books and Arts on RN Summer. I'm Sarah Kanoski. William Boyd is one of the UK's best-selling novelists, and his latest book, Sweet Caress, puts at its centre an intrepid female photographer. I think you'll like her as much as I did. My conversation with William Boyd is up first on today's show. Later, Daniel Mendelsohn, a critic, translator and author who was in Australia last year for the Sydney Writers' Festival. And I spoke with Daniel Mendelsohn about the experience of reading Homer's Odyssey with his dad. And we'll finish with frontman of the Black Eyed Susans, Rob Snarsky, who's going to share his love of the American band Television. That's all ahead on Books and Arts this afternoon. I hope you can stay with me.
Ist ein kleines Herz für mich noch frei, Baby, oder warten drauf, schon zwei bis drei, Baby.
In Sweet Caress, the latest novel from William Boyd, the heroine Amory Clay is a photographer. And her career takes her from the demi-monde of Berlin in the 1920s, to New York in the 30s, to the Blackshirt Riots in London, and to France in the Second World War. It's a life of adventure that she's taking a reckoning of as her 70th birthday looms. William Boyd, welcome to Books and Arts. I have to say, I fell a bit in love with Amory. She's spirited and brave, but flawed in convincing ways too. Did she come to you fully formed?
I wanted to write the life of a woman. That was the main thing, because I've written two long lives about men, and my initial impulse was to start with a woman's life and try to write a whole life. And then what happens next is a series of questions and answers that I put to myself, saying, who is she, where is she born, how old is she, etc., etc. And the answers I get to those questions begin to build up this portrait of her. And I then decided she'd be a photographer. And so it becomes, by a process of accretion, you begin to create this person, and with all her flaws and virtues and her characteristics and her nature and so forth. So it's a slow process, and I usually take 2 years to figure out a novel and then a year or so to write it. So that 2 year process of invention, the period of invention as I call it, is the time when I piece together this individual and really get a sense of who she is and what she's like, but in every tiny detail.
Mm. As you say, she's a photographer. What did giving her that profession allow you to do in the novel?
Well, it's quite interesting. I mean, I'm very interested in photography, and I've written a lot about photography, and I've actually written the introduction to some photographers', you know, collected works and so on. So I have my photograph taken all the time as well, being a novelist. So and I've had my photograph taken by very famous photographers. So I became very intrigued by the profession. And one of the interesting things about the history of the development of photography is that women started out on an equal basis with men. There was no glass ceiling, and this we're talking before World War One here, and so it was a very egalitarian profession from the outset. And I thought that by making Amory a photographer, it would allow me to send her places and have her do things that she wouldn't have been able to do had she just been, you know, a housewife and a mother or a civil servant or something like that. Because she's born in 1908 and she dies in 1983. So her life covers a great swathe of the 20th century. But it was interesting that at the beginning of her life as a teenager, she starts out as a society photographer. And it's entirely plausible. There was no impediment to women doing that kind of job then. So it was both pragmatic in the sense that I could have a journey all over the place and do all sorts of interesting things, but also really quite interesting that a woman could be an independent professional in the 1920s in that profession. In other ways, she couldn't.
And not just independent, but able to travel the world and experience dramatic events that, as you say, without the badge of photographer would have been presumably blocked to her.
Yes, it's really interesting because I've done a tremendous amount of research, obviously, into the women in the photography profession, particularly between the wars, and they all seem to live long lives and interesting rackety lives as well, which is quite intriguing. So it was a very good choice, and of course it allowed me to have photographs in the novel,
which is the most wonderful conceit, and so surprised me when I first seeing that these black and white images kept appearing and you know, delighted and kind of confused me a little bit. When did you decide at what point in the story to include these wonderful array of photographs?
Quite early on, actually, because I've also written another book called Nat Tate, which was a famous art hoax where I created this American artist. And in that book, in order to make the hoax work, I used a lot of anonymous photographs, or found photographs, as they're called, and gave them captions and gave the characters in them names. And it worked fantastically well. And I realized that in Amory's case, because she was a photographer, I could use more anonymous photographs to show the work she does, but also to show the people she meets or falls in love with and so on. And so very early on, I thought, I'm going to have photographs in the book, and there are actually 73 altogether, which I think is unprecedented in a novel. I wasn't sure if it would work, actually. I thought, will it fight with the fiction or not? When she describes her house and then you turn the page and you see a photograph of her house, will one cancel out the other? But in actual fact, it doesn't. It's a very, very strange enhancement of the fiction.
Absolutely. It makes me think, why don't all novels have photographs? Exactly. I think you've stumbled on an essential new feature of the novel.
I think so. It makes it seem incredibly real. And yet it is obviously a novel, and these photographs are obviously, you know, found. They're not photographs I've commissioned or taken myself.
Well, I was. Where did you get them from? I mean, that was part of the wonder I had as I was reading.
Yeah, well, because I used anonymous photographs in this little book, Nat Tate, I have quite a collection myself, and I bought a lot of albums, discarded family albums in France in particular. They seem to throw out their family photograph albums randomly. So I have quite a lot, but then your car boot sales and junk shops, and also, of course, online now. You can buy photographs online. There are sites and there are auction sites where photographs are for sale, but they're anonymous photographs. And so I had a whole parallel creative experience, not only writing the book, but actually searching for photographs. And I think I ended up buying close to 2,000 photographs, you know, for pennies, really. They're not valuable. And from them made a selection of 73. But sometimes I'd have to buy 800 photographs to find two good ones.
One of my favourite photographs that are included in this novel, William, is of Amory in a swimsuit, sort of larking about in a pond when she's aged 20 or so. It's so joyful. And although this book traverses the great heavy horrors of the 20th century, world wars, Vietnam, the rise of fascism, there's a sweet pleasure that she finds in life, regardless of the luck that she's dealt. There's a pleasure and a sweetness that she's open to.
Yes, I mean, hence the title as well. I mean, I have an epigraph of at the beginning of the book, which is, life is worth living as long as you've experienced its sweet caress from time to time. And so Amory does experience life's sweet caress. She has a lot of bad luck, but there are moments of intense happiness, and she's aware of them. And in a way, that's what fulfills her. And they can be very banal and very run-of-the-mill, but there's something about her nature that recognises these moments where she's caressed by life's sweetness and savours it.
Her lover, Charbonneau, how am I pronouncing his name, William?
That's right, Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau, yes.
He tells Amory, that life is for amusement, that we are there to be amused by life and don't hang around, basically, when that sense of amusement goes. And she wonders, as she's getting older, whether that savouring of the amusement of life is fading. But I wondered what the nature of that amusement is, because as we're saying, it can't be the same as ease or as fun, because there's a lot of difficulty, a lot of heartbreak in Amory's life, but there's a kind of, an interest, a curiosity about what's going to happen and who she'll be in that moment.
Yes, I think so. And I think, again, that's something that defines my view of the human condition, and I sort of present it time and again in my novels, that in a way, the way to look at life is through a comic lens or a comically absurd lens rather than a tragic, hand-wringing point of view. I think that if you see the comedy of life and the serious comedy, if you like, of life, then somehow it's easier to take the bad moments that come along. One of my favorite authors is Vladimir Nabokov, the Russian author, and he has a saying which I often say to myself, which is, a good laugh is the best pesticide. And I think, I remember that when I'm feeling particularly angry or frustrated or down in the dumps. And you step back from your immediate situation and you see it in a context of your human nature and your humanity. And very often it's a smile that comes to your face rather than a tear to your eye.
And I think that sort of bittersweetness characterises her romantic relationships. One of the quite lovely aspects is the friendships she forms with people that she almost sleeps with but doesn't. And there's a different sort of intimacy she thinks that happens in their closeness that's not quite sexual but not platonic either.
Yes, I think so. And I think particularly as she gets older, she recognises that some of the men she encounters are sexually interested in her, but she's not going there. She wises up, Amory, because her life is, as I said, quite a rackety, difficult one. So she's quite sure of herself. And particularly in the end, towards the end of her life, when she's reflecting on what she's lived through and what she's experienced, so she takes people as she finds them, and is quite happy to keep that on a level of amused, speculative friendship.
Mm. Particularly because her marriage with the wonderfully named Sholto Farr and the gorgeously handsome Sholto Farr, given by the photograph you included, the imaginary photograph of him, is, you know, in lots of epic novels, that marriage would be, you know, he's a Scottish lord, wealthy lord. This would be the culminating moment. But it's not for Amory. She almost suffers a kind of diminishment in herself. She stops taking photographs. She kind of retreats from the world in this marriage, which has got all sorts of different problems in it.
Yes, I think that there's no doubt that it is the great love of her life when she meets Sholto in World War II, and he's a commander of a commando unit, and they encounter each other in Germany towards the end of World War II, and it is a kind of lightning strike, coup de foudre of love at first sight, and they do conspire, or Sholto conspires, to meet her again, and the love affair, I think, is entirely genuine and very passionate and all-consuming. But the problem is that Sholto is traumatized by what he went through in World War II, and I think that's true of a lot of that generation of soldier, or any soldier in a way, because war touches Amory's life through her father, through her brother, and through Sholto. But Sholto's traumatization is particularly acute, and he becomes a self-destructive alcoholic, and that's what clouds the marriage unbelievably. And it's a kind of he has a kind of death wish, and is trying to die at a very young age. And there are certain English writers who I think have had the same death wish, and I've sort of made a study of them, one of them being Evelyn Waugh, for example, and the other one being Ian Fleming, who wrote the James Bond novels. These are men who died very young, but through their, almost by their own hand, by their own self-neglect, they wanted to die for various reasons and made sure they did. And Sholto through the misery of his recollections of what he did in World War II, even though he's happily married, in love, with children, he's overshadowed by these memories, and in a way they bring about his self-destruction.
There is an enormous amount of drinking in Sweet Caress, I have to say, William. Everyone's downing gins and whiskies and wine left, right and centre.
Yes, well, I think that's very of the period. We're all very conscious now of alcoholic units and how much we should drink and the consequences of over-drinking. But of course, before the 1980s, people didn't really give a thought to it at all. I mean, there's a lot of smoking and drinking going on, but it's all very authentic.
And I think that alcohol is part of the sociability and the conviviality and its positive side, I suppose, but it's also of this clearly attempting to mask the traumas that the world wars have had on the men in Amory's life and in her own. Alcohol there is this sort of as a medication, I suppose.
Yes, it is a medication. You're absolutely right. But also, the other thing that people took were huge amounts of what we'd call prescription drugs now, the uppers and downers, amphetamines and sleeping pills or sleeping draughts. But people not only smoked and drank in huge quantities, but they ingested large amounts of very powerful drugs to help them get through the day. So you're absolutely right. It's a kind of socially accepted self-medication, and that people who had three large gin and tonics before lunch were not frowned upon or looked on as sort of, you know, dangerously overdoing it. It was just something one did.
You mentioned, William, that we do follow Amory on her whole life, and it's the story is chronological, but really from quite early on we have these intercut sections of her as an elderly woman in Barrendale, the island of Barrendale in Scotland. What do you want to say about this iteration of Amory?
Well, I mean, there's a sense in which it's a structure of the book that I decided to impose on it, in that that we cut back, if you like, from Barrendale in 1977, this island off the west coast of Scotland where she's living. She's about to be 70, and she's looking back on her life. And so we see her life as a series of long flashbacks, and we keep coming back to Amory's present moment. And so it's a way of technically allowing me to recount her life in its totality, from her young childhood through to her maturity. But also it allows me to cover a huge swathe of time. I mean, it's quite a long book, Sweet Caress. It's 450 pages, but I think if I'd written it chronologically, it might have been 2,000 pages. so it's a kind of technical novelist's structure that allows me to get a quart into a pint pot. we do the whole of Amory's life, and you seem to have covered almost every year of her 70 years existence. But in fact, by a kind of narrative sleight of hand, I've managed to make it something of an illusion. Of course I can't do every year of her life, otherwise the book would be impossibly long. But because of this flashback device, I'm able to give the impression that her whole life has been covered in intense detail and intense reflection.
There's an perhaps inevitable sort of sadness, I think, though, in the contrast between the tales of her as a young, vivid, adventurous woman with her love affairs and her involvement in the great moments of 20th century history, against the very quiet, smaller, I suppose, life that she's leading as an older woman. I mean, it's a sadness that she's attentive to as well, about how to maintain that amusement that we talked of previously, how to maintain that into old age.
Yes, and I think it is true. I mean, it's very beautiful where she lives. I know that west coast of Scotland extremely well, and so there's a kind of visual charge every day when you live in that kind of landscape. And she's savouring the smaller details of her life in the way that she savoured the big adventures. She has a friend on the island who's a a woman scientist who was a cosmologist who studied the Big Bang. You can't get a more epic subject than that, but who's abandoned cosmology and now studies small mollusks and rock pools around the west coast of Scotland. And in a way, that's a symbol of the journey that Amory has gone on, from hurling herself into life with all her enthusiasm and openness. As time has gone by, she's retreated to this cottage on an island off the west coast of Scotland, but her life is still very full, emotionally and visually and intellectually. It's just its parameters have contracted enormously, but she's still living, I'd say, as intensely as she lived as a young woman. It's just that she doesn't rove as far and wide as she used to.
There's a neighbour, Hugo Torrance, who's interested in becoming amorous with Amory, and she has the sad thought that he'd be the last man I'd ever kiss. You know, not that he was something terribly terrible about him, but just that there was an end point to this adventuring.
Yes, I think so. She's taking account of her life, and there's a certain amount of quantifying that goes on. She has a rather wonderful sister called Dido, who is very promiscuous and who's had love affairs with over 50 men, and this prompts Amory to tot up her own sort of sexual life and realizes that she's only loved or made love to 5 men, and here's Hugo Torrance, possibly the 6th or not. So it's part of the reckoning up. It's part of the looking back and analysing her journey, you know, on this small planet. As she says, we're a certain kind of ape on a small planet circling an insignificant star.
William Boyd discussing his latest novel, Sweet Caress, on Books and Arts last year. You are with Books and Arts here on RN Summer. I'm Sarah Kanoski. The critic Daniel Mendelsohn next. Daniel Mendelsohn is a critic, writer, and translator. You might have read him in The New Yorker or The New York Review of Books. Daniel has one of those wonderfully wide-ranging critical minds. He writes with erudition and passion on everything from Mad Men to Herodotus. And when I spoke with Daniel at the Sydney Writers' Festival last year, he was working on a new book about reading Homer's Odyssey with his dad.
I actually read the Odyssey when I was in high school, I think it must have been. And I remember very specifically the circumstances. My father had a colleague whose wife was a high school English teacher in the school that I attended. And she wasn't my teacher, but she knew I was already sort of interested in mythology. And it's funny because I write about her in my new book. And she said to me at one point, well, you know, if you're interested in mythology, you should really try the Odyssey. Students your age just love it. So I read it, and I was hooked for life, basically.
And why at that age in particular? What is it about that story?
Well, I think that, you know, in general, I mean, that's the received wisdom, that younger people like the Odyssey, and as you get older, the Iliad starts making more sense to you, which is much tougher. It's about war. It's a very grim story in many ways. But the Odyssey is, look, it's sort of proto-science fiction, right? It's adventures in these strange realms with peculiar creatures and monsters and aliens and drugs and magic potions and transformations. And so I think to the young child's imagination, or a sort of a young adult's imagination, it's got everything you could want.
Except it's interesting, the Iliad is the book, the epic of young manhood, of sort of machismo, and the Odyssey is a book of old age.
It's about, yes, at least middle age, right? And so, well, also, I think you're right, actually, because, of course, Odysseus's final reunion is not actually with his wife, it's with his father. So there's a sense of coming full circle. And yet, you could say that its concerns might be middle age, but its plot is filled with fun. You know, it's fun. And also, I would say the crucial thing is that there's a lot of humor in the Odyssey. You know, there are jokes and puns and all kinds of things that make it sort of enjoyable. It's got a lot of plot, and I think young people like that. So it certainly got me hooked, at any rate.
And just the name itself, Odysseus, that's a rich word in and of itself.
Yes, I mean, the interesting thing about the name of Odysseus, which is the subject of great debate, is that it's connected to the Greek word odune, or it seems to be, which is the word for pain. And there's some element, you know, we think that his sufferings on his return home are what makes him his character in some way. And so he is the man of pain, right? That's what his name means. And there's actually an extended flashback in the Odyssey to the naming, the moment when as a baby, he got his name from a very difficult grandfather, a sort of trickster character, who basically says, you know, I've caused a lot of people a lot of pain, and so I'm going to give my grandson this name. And yet that's a theme of the Odyssey. He suffers a lot to get what he wants.
He suffers, and he's a trickster, or a bullshitter, as you describe him.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very funny, because in the book that I'm writing is about the experience I had of reading the Odyssey with my late father in what turned out to be the last year of his life. And my father was a scientist and really didn't like Odysseus, actually. It's very funny. And the reason why is that we, you know, people like us who are journalists and writers and, you know, love Odysseus because he's a fabulist. You know, he makes up stories, he lies, he bullshits his way through situations. And my father has a very kind of mathematical mind. Couldn't bear any of that. You know, he said, why is this guy such a hero? He lies all the time. And I thought, that's the difference between a mathematician and a writer. You know, we think he's great. You know, in some way, I always think he's sort of the proto Woody Allen. He's sexy because he's smart. You know, he's not like Achilles. He's not the greatest warrior. He's not the fastest runner. He can't bench press 300 pounds. But he seduces people all the time, both literally and figuratively, because he has a way with words. So how could people like us resist that? You know? Or how could readers resist that?
So when you say that this is not the kind of intellectual world that your own father came out of, why did you both decide to read the book together?
Well, it was my father's idea, actually. He had, as many people then did, when he was a teenager in the 1940s, going to a public school in New York City, studied Latin. And actually, as is true of many math-oriented kids, he was very good at Latin. And he had this idea, and he always encouraged me to study the classics, sort of vicariously. He liked the idea that I was going on where he had not. He just wanted to reread the classics. So I said to him, you know, well, I'm actually teaching a seminar for first-year students. You know, we're talking about 17 and 18-year-old freshmen at university. And he said, I'll come. I'll sit in on it. And that was the beginning of this sort of, you know, our own Odyssey. And he came every week. He drove 3.5 hours from the house I grew up in to where I teach. And he sat in, you know, not quietly, I must say, you know, sort of cantankerously disagreeing with me about everything. But that was the origin of this sort of very interesting adventure we had.
And you then did the thing that all good readers of the Odyssey should do, which is you go to Greece and you try to follow in Odysseus's footsteps.
Well, what happened was, so that was the spring term of 2011, which runs from January to May. And just by coincidence, although I'm beginning to think there are no coincidences, an old mentor of mine said, well, you know, I just heard about this cruise that recreates the voyages of Odysseus, follows in the footsteps of Odysseus from Troy to Ithaca over 2 weeks, whatever it was. So I mentioned this to my father half jokingly, because my father, among other things, is notoriously cheap. He hated to spend money. And I said, well, you know, I heard about, and he said, let's go. I thought, good grief, you know, in his old age, he's relaxing. And he said, I want you to get the nicest cabin. And because I think he was very pleased with himself that he had followed this course and that he really had mastered this text, even though he didn't much like Odysseus. And we went on this cruise, which was extraordinary. You know, you think, oy, 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 it's going to be a little goofy. And I have to say, well, imagine who goes on an Odyssey cruise. And this was, I should say, it was very serious. You know, it was not a thing you go on because you want all-you-can-eat shrimp, you know. there was a reading list. There were two lectures a day by classicists, archaeologists, you know. So it was serious. And wonderful people. We made such good friends, you know, people, Odyssey groupies, people who had interesting family stories, a family who just lost a sister, wanted to do something that was meaningful to them. You know, so this idea of the man of pain came back and interesting. A Dutch, elderly Dutch gentleman who had been saved during World War II by the intervention of a classics professor said he wanted to go as a sort of a repayment of this great gift he had had from this classics professor in 1945. So, you know, who knows? But that itself was so Odyssean, right? That everyone has a story and you don't know what it is until you sit down over a meal and people start talking. Yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's kind of appropriate in terms of the misadventures that Odysseus has on his journey that you didn't actually make it to Ithaca.
No. So the joke was, of course you're supposed to end in Ithaca, this island, which people think is the Ithaca of Odysseus. And what happened was, this is in June of 2011, there was a general strike. It was when the Greek sort of crisis was at its nadir. And the people who the workers who operate the Corinth canals were on strike. And that meant for us to get back to Athens in time for our flights back to wherever people were coming from, we had to miss Ithaca because we had to sail around the entire country of Greece, basically, to get back from where we were to Athens. So people, at that point, people knew what I was up to, my dad and I, and I, at that point I knew I was going to write a book about this. And people kept coming up to me and saying, oh, this is so terrible for you, you know, here after all this, you're never going to get to Ithaca. And I said, no, this is so great, actually. It's so Odyssean that your destination always eludes you, you know. And I thought it was actually kind of great. So the captain of the ship, who knew I was a writer and a translator of the modern Greek poet Cavafy, who has a very famous poem called Ithaca, said to me very kindly, he said, you know, we have to do something during this day we have at sea with nothing except sailing. And he said, since we're not going to get to the real Ithaca, would you mind giving a lecture about Cavafy's poem, Ithaca, and that will be our Ithaca. So I just thought it was so ideal, actually. The substitution of literature for life was somehow so Homeric. I thought it was great.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's another, as you say, you've translated Constantine Cavafy, the Alexandrine poet, who took Homeric themes in a range of his works, and as well as that beautiful poem Ithaca, which is about the journey and the journey over the destination, which is a terrible, that sounds like a Hallmark card as opposed to the Cavafy poem. But there's this other wonderful poem of his I love about the Odyssey, which is a much more severe work, the Second Odyssey, where Odysseus leaves again.
Yeah, it's an early, one of Cavafy's early poems that he then sort of came back to and reworked as the poem we know as Ithaca. And you're right, you know, to describe Ithaca as always makes it sound so Hallmarky, you know, but it isn't, as we know. But A Second Odyssey is very tough, and it's interesting because in the 19th century you have a number of poems which explore what you might call the dark side of the Odyssey, or rather Odysseus, which is when you are a person for whom the voyage is more important than the destination, the question then arises, are you ever going to be happy when you finally do get home? And that, you know, is something that I thought about a lot when I was working, as I'm concluding my book, actually, about this experience, because in that poem, as you rightly point out, Odysseus already has his eye on leaving and hitting the road again and going home. Tennyson famously has a poem, Ulysses, which is about the same thing, that once he gets home, he realized that what he really liked was not being home, mm. which was traveling. So that kind of tension between the pleasures of voyaging and exploring and seeing new worlds and the satisfactions of coming home are always in a kind of suspicious competition with each other, you know, and there's definitely a sense already in the Odyssey that the kind of person you have to be Odysseus makes you the kind of person that maybe isn't a person who wants to sit around playing checkers with Penelope and drinking, you know, herbal tea once you get home. You know.
So there's that devastating line, it bored him and he left.
Mm. Yeah. So I think that's in that sense, the not arriving, the sense that your destination is always over the horizon and you have to go a little bit further. It's already present in the Odyssey. You know, there are many instances in the Odyssey where the men sort of want to get back on the ship because they sense that there's some danger. And Odysseus says, no, I'm just very curious to see what this island is like. And then something terrible happens.
5 years pass.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it's also about curiosity. I think it's also a parable about intellectual curiosity, which is never ending. But if, you know, if you always want to see over the next ridge, so to speak, intellectually, where does it end? Can you always be in motion? There's a wonderful episode in the Odyssey that sort of dramatizes what you might call the dangers of that where Odysseus ends up on a floating island, the island of Aeolus, the king of the winds, which the island itself is always in motion. And there's something very creepy about that. You know, you want to, most of us anyway, want to arrive at a fixed destination that's not mobile. And so you always feel with that one episode that there's something creepy. He has six sons and six daughters and they're all married to each other. There's this sort of endless circularity that's not quite wholesome, you know.
Daniel, I wonder if the experience of reading the Odyssey with your father, did it lead you to reflect on the book in a different way? Did your father's criticisms of Odysseus, say, make you see this book that you know so well in a new light?
Well, I think that it forced me, as all good students do, you know, to re-examine my own assumptions. You know, my father basically had two main problems. And that was, A, how heroic is Odysseus, really? You know, we keep talking about him as a hero, and yet he said, all kidding aside, you know, his lies get people in trouble. You know, there's something to be said for the fact that he's the only one of the Ithacan contingent that returns home from the Trojan War alive. How good a leader is he?
He's a survivor, perhaps, rather than a hero.
Right, exactly. And I think my father was right to attach to this slightly uneasy quality, you know, about the Odyssey. If you're going to be the hero of the poem, you have to be alone, right? You have to be the only one standing at the end of the war. And he also had a lot of problem with the gods, as many students do. You know, how much of what Odysseus does is his own cleverness? How much is he being helped by Athena? You know, my father, who was a self-made man, and this is the sort of running joke of my book, he couldn't bear the idea that Odysseus got any help. You know, and there are many instances in the Odyssey where he washes up on an island and Athena sort of waves a magic wand and he looks fabulous and his hair is perfect and everything. My father hated that stuff. But all kidding aside, it was very touching for me because I had a real sense of that aspect of my dad, you know, that he had done it all himself and he didn't like the idea that some smooth-talking seducer had a whole epic devoted to him when he gets all this help from the gods, you know. So a lot of the book is about, you know, my experience. I was close to my father, you know, but I understood a lot about him from reading this poem together. And that's sort of the best thing that can happen when you're reading, you know, is to have insight not only into yourself, but into other people as well. The poem became a kind of a lantern that illuminated aspects of my dad's personality that I hadn't really appreciated before, you know, and his absolute opposition to the idea that you would get help in your project was very touching for me, you know.
The writer, critic and translator Daniel Mendelsohn, who was in Australia last year for the Sydney Writers' Festival. And you get a sense of the range of Daniel's critical interests by the fact that when he was at the Writers' Festival, he was on a panel about TV with Ben Law and a panel about the classics with David Malouf and another panel on translation. So he's got a pretty unique critical mind. I really recommend his essays if you haven't come across them yet. And that memoir on reading the Odyssey with his dad will be published soon. You're with Books and Arts on RN. I'm Sarah Kanoski. You're with Books and Arts on RN. I'm Sarah Kanoski. In 1977, the American band Television, frontman Tom Verlaine, guitarist Richard Lloyd, drummer Billy Fricker and bass player Fred Smith released their debut LP, Marquee Moon. The album never sold too well, but if the band had earned money from influence, they'd be millionaires. One of the teenagers blown away by Television was Rob Snarsky. He's lead singer of Melbourne band The Black Eyed Susans. Welcome to Books and Arts, Rob.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
And you have chosen Marquee Moon by Television as your masterpiece choice. Why?
Why? Probably because it was so striking when I first heard it, and it's really stayed with me. There's been maybe a handful of moments when music I've come across has simply stopped me in my tracks, and I've literally had to stop everything I was doing to tune into a song or a sound. And I remember the moment I heard Marquee Moon for the first time. And
where
really
were you?
Compelling.
What was happening?
I was about 19, so it was a bit later than its actual release, and I was at my parents' house, just hanging out in my room. Someone had given me a tape of it. I remember putting it on, pressing play, and I was just completely dumbstruck. It felt like I was listening to a different musical language, something I'd never heard before, and I really needed to tune in closely to understand it.
Well, what kind of music were you listening to at the time? Like, what was in your ears before that?
Well, I think this was like a portal to alternative music. For me, you know, I'd been listening to commercial radio, and Dad would be listening to Golden Hits. And as kids, we always watched Countdown and whatever music video shows were on at the time. But, you know, we didn't have Triple J and we didn't really have Rage. So we weren't exposed to a lot of music like this, and hearing it for the first time was phenomenal.
You'd been kind of immersed in the world of mainstream or popular music, and then you hear this cassette. What was the sound? What struck you about what was different?
I think it was the intertwining guitar play between Lloyd and Verlaine. The abrasive nature of the rhythm guitar with the opening track, See No Evil, was kind of slightly out of tune. The second guitar was sort of riffing and intertwining, and there was this sort of brash, taut twang and urgency from Verlaine's vocal. They really just sounded like they came from another planet. I kind of wanted to know where and how to get there.
It's actually, I've got to confess that it's one of those albums that I'd always heard about as this seminal moment in music, and you know, I've said I really should listen to that LP, but I only just listened to it in preparation to talking to you, Rob, and it is fantastic. It is absolutely one of those, it's like sort of reading Kafka for the first time. You think, yeah, this lives up to the hype. It's an amazing piece of music still.
It is. I think they're a truly original band. They were very hard to define. They were part of that CBGB's punk scene back in the day, with bands like Blondie and the Ramones and Talking Heads and Patti Smith. They were a really unconventional band. They looked like no one, they sounded like no one, and, you know, it's sort of part punk, part avant-garde, part jazz. And, you know, I've sort of been doing a bit of research and reading about them, and my favourite moment was when they were auditioning for a couple of labels, and they had this strange setup where they were auditioning in a recording studio. So the band was in one room and Verlaine was in a vocal booth, and the guys from Atlantic, I think, were sort of sitting there listening to them, trying to work out, you know, if they were right for their label. And Richard Lloyd walked off at some point and overheard one of the A&R guys saying, "I can't sign this band. This isn't Earth music." And I
thought, which is kind of perfect. Well, that's what struck you, it sounds like, in your first hearing. It was a portal to another world. It was not Earth music.
It really was. It really was. And it's up until recently, because I have given it a rest, I found it hard to find any other bands that sounded remotely like them. But listening to them again recently, I can hear that their influence has been widespread. You can sort of hear it in bits and pieces of music these days. And maybe it's also because of, you know, how young I was at the time. It's over 30 years now that I heard it. So I can see they've rubbed off on other people.
And as you say, Rob, they grew out of that punk scene in New York in the 70s. But, I mean, I couldn't call this a punk album. Like, they can play their instruments. Well, it's very melodic. It doesn't seem to me like a punk album.
Absolutely. They were very adept musicians, really clever. There's this angular, obtuse guitar interplay and intertwining melodic lines. The drumming's great. It's not like he's losing time. He has these splashy, open hi-hat fills every now and again and hits the toms, and it's almost a bit like, you know, surf music drumming at times as well. It's and the bass player's really solid. So it's the rhythm section gives the guitarist space to do what they want to do, and Verlaine writes these sort of abstract lyrics. They're kind of nonsensical in a way, but they get you in. He's quite funny at times as well.
What about his vocals? I read one review that described them as ovine, which I then had to look up what that meant, and it means sheep-like, which I felt was a bit harsh.
Well,
has that come across you as you've been listening to this album over 30 years? That's an ovine-like vocal from Tom Verlaine.
It's a bit strangled. I can see where they're coming from, but that gives it that sort of sense of urgency. And goes well with when they are sort of hitting their straps on something like See No Evil. It sits there perfectly.
And it is a bit, I think, resonant of Patti Smith's vocal delivery too. It is that sort of style, that kind of high in the chest, intense vocal delivery.
Yeah, really taut, very sort of high and nasally as well. And I guess that's what draws you into the lyrics too. You know, you sort of, if you have a smooth singer, quite often they can be beautiful melodically, but they don't deliver the words, whereas I can't say that about Tom Verlaine. Mm. He delivers those words, as strange as they are and as cryptic and poetic as they can be.
What about the look of the album? You know, because I think that's part of the excitement of this kind of music. It was a whole aesthetic as well that was happening, and the cover photo is so striking. I think it was taken by Robert Mapplethorpe.
It was taken by Robert Mapplethorpe. He also did the inside shot. But what's interesting about it is that it was photocopied. And that's what they used.
This is great. Cassettes and photocopies. We're evoking a whole lost world of technology today, Rob Stanislaw.
In American talk, it was Xeroxed. And they liked it and they used it. Same with the back. The back, they were trying to get this sort of swirly eye happening, something that was kind of hypnotic. And look, it's okay, but it's not as good as you probably could do today, but hey, 1977.
with your Xerox machine, they did what they could.
But I love the Mapplethorpe photograph inside. It's like a barren room. It's not even greatly lit. You know, as a photographer, he'd probably be kicking himself.
So there's a sort of a rawness.
For the poor quality. It's an absolute rawness to it. It's just fantastic.
You'd say, Rob,
so
about
sparse.
About the influence that you can hear of this album in other musicians. How has it influenced you musically, do you think, television's Marquee Moon?
I think in the early days when I had a band called Chad's Tree with my brother, I remember as soon as I heard this tape, I took it out of the tape machine, found him and said, I want us to sound like this. This is incredible. Honestly, the guitars, because Mark and I had been playing guitar together for a number of months, but we hadn't really found our sound, and this really affected it. It gave us something to reach to, you know. It gave us a purpose and an intent.
What happened to them after this album, Rob? Because this is, you know, it's always name-checked as this hugely important moment.
They made another record called Adventure. They just didn't have a lot of commercial success, and I think they drifted off and everyone had solo projects. They actually came out to Australia about 2 years ago, I think.
Did you see them?
I can't believe I wasn't in town to see
them. Oh,
that.
No. Yeah,
so I missed them.
Maybe they were terrible.
No, I've heard really good reports. I heard the band was exceptional, but Verlaine had possibly lost some of that
ovine quality.
He no longer sounded like a sheep.
Nothing lasts forever, Rob. This is Books on Arts on RN. I'm Sarah Kanoski, and my guest for Masterpiece today is Rob Snarski, who's been describing the album by American band Television, their debut album Marquee Moon, released in 1977. You've got a new album yourself, Rob, and it's fan requests.
It is. It came out of a very humble project. It was crowdfunding. I was making Wounded Bird, which was an album that came out last year. And one of the things that I suggested to folk who were interested in helping to finance that record was I could record your favourite song on my iPhone and email it across to you. So
it's a great project.
Songs that people wanted to hear me sing, or their favourite song, or whatever. So I ended up with, you know, over 30 songs at one point. And I found myself listening to them and thinking, you know what, there's something about the sort of honesty, the relaxed nature of the singing. And then I thought, there's something within that quality that makes it sort of interesting, and more interesting than sort of being in a studio where you're so aware of what's going down on tape.
There's such a range of artists and songs, you know, people from Pulp to Elton John to Merle Haggard.
That was the great
thing
about
it. Were they doing it to tease you with any of them, do you think? Were they all serious requests?
Well, I don't think anyone really needed to hear an a cappella version of Danny Boy sung by me, so that's not on there. Look, I made
it pretty
clear. Yeah, I made it pretty clear that I didn't want to have anything that was too difficult. There was not going to be any Bach, or there wasn't going to be any Hendrix or any Television. That was not going to happen. It was going to be songs that you could imagine a singer-songwriter singing simply with his guitar in a lounge room or kitchen. And we're halfway through the tour, so it's been great to see the songs and hear the songs grow as well in a live setting.
And I think in years to come, when Books and Arts is sort of celebrating its 30th anniversary, there'll be some musician now, Rob, who can bring that in as their masterpiece. And I'll have the conversation with them about it. And the full cycle of musical life will close.
That would be lovely. And remember to send me the link, because I'd like to hear it.
Rob Snarski, thank you for coming in for Masterpiece today.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Rob Snarski's latest album is Low Fidelity, Songs by Request, Volume 1. That's it for Books and Arts today, and the exciting news is that as of next week, we're back with a whole stack of fresh, new, exciting interviews and stories with you on Books and Arts, beginning with Michael Cathcart on Monday at 10. I look forward to joining you next week too. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for your company, and enjoy the rest of your afternoon with RN.